we'll nourish you with the variety of our choices. Works from near and far. Music written 800 years ago and written this year. We'll ease you calmly out of the night and give you the energy needed for the new day. With news updates and cultural stories and musical suggestions from you. Radio 3 Breakfast, live first thing 7 days a week. Or take breakfast whenever it suits you on BBC Sounds.
It's midday and time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the former Bishop of Edinburgh, Richard Holloway.
In 1948, at the age of just 14, Richard Holloway left his home in a small town near Glasgow to train for the priesthood at an Anglican monastery in Nottinghamshire. Nearly four decades later, after working in some of Scotland's most deprived inner-city parishes, he was appointed Bishop of Edinburgh and Primus of the Scottish Episcopal Church. But in 2000, he resigned, unable any longer to reconcile his religious doubts and his views, especially on gay rights, with church orthodoxy. As he's navigated his unusual spiritual journey, he's remained an honest, compassionate voice, cutting through dogma, unafraid to engage with uncertainty and to celebrate our humanity. Richard Holloway has presented many radio series and written 33 books, the latest being Stories We Tell Ourselves, Making Meaning in a Meaningless Universe, an exploration of how we can try to make sense of our fleeting lives in a post-religious world. Richard, you've brought us music today by Rachmaninoff, Elgar, Brahms, Nyman, and I think your response to music has always been a pretty emotional one, yes?
Yes, I come from a family of singers. My wife's a trained singer. My children sing well. I've always had a good voice, but I've been unable to read music. And I suppose it touches me emotionally. And I'm a very emotional character anyway. It makes me cry. And I suppose that's why music is the best kind of spiritual language, because it doesn't get at you in the heavy-handed way that a lot of religious language does, which is why it's now I prefer when I go to church now to go to choral evensong, where I won't be got at by a sermon.
Well, for some of us, music is our religion. Does that make sense?
It does absolutely make sense, because it's mystical. We are very extraordinary creatures, we humans. I mean, billions of years into the existence of the universe, we've come along, and in us, the universe is thinking about itself. Art is our greatest achievement. Music, I don't know how you put that into words. I mean, it's a bit like putting a painting into words, but it says something about the extraordinary nature of the human mind, the human psyche, that the universe, after 18 billion years, has started singing to itself. I mean, I don't know whether you take that except to sit in awe, I think.
We're going to start with the beautiful Scottish song Car the Yows, collected by Robert Burns in the late 18th century. Now, as you've mentioned, you come from a family of singers, so am I right to picture you all singing this together in your house in Edinburgh?
We haven't had a Christmas together because of COVID for a while, but when we do, and we had one, I think, last about 3 years ago, when we're doing the washing up, this is always the one we end with. And my son has a wonderful baritone. My daughter, Sarah, has a lovely mezzo-soprano. And my wife, of course, is a trained soprano. So they give it, as we say in Scotland, laldy. But it's a sad kind of song.
It is.
It's a song about shepherding. And my God, it's impossible to hear it without dabbing the tears from your eyes.
Call the yows, tae the nows.
Call the yows, tae the nows. Call the mother and the nows. Call the mother burning.
Car the Owls, a Scottish folk song collected by Robbie Burns. We heard Michael Brewer directing Laudibus in that arrangement by Ralph Vaughan Williams, whose 150th anniversary we're celebrating this year. Richard Holloway, as I've said, you live in Edinburgh now and have done for most of the last few decades, but we're actually brought up in a working-class family in the town of Alexandria, not far from Glasgow. What was it like growing up there?
It was wonderful. It was very warm. I mean, when you're a poor kid, you're not aware you're poor if you've got loving parents. And I had very loving parents, especially my mother. I can even remember some of her endearments. She used to call me her wee ton of bricks. So if you're surrounded by that kind of love and everyone else in the street is living the same kind of life, you don't kind of notice it. You just notice the love you're getting. And of course, the Vale of Leven, Alexandria is in the Vale of Leven, surrounded by wonderful hills, and I was a romantic wee hill walker as a boy.
You were just 14, as we've mentioned, when you left home to live at Kelham Monastery in Nottinghamshire to train for the priesthood. That's quite an early age, isn't it, to feel you have a vocation?
Yeah, I guess it is. My wee cousin died and the rector of St. Mungo's Episcopal Church came in to arrange the funeral and asked my mother who I was and can he sing? She said, that's my son Dick. Dick's got a good voice. And I turned up the following Sunday and he turned this wee red stone church at Bunbury in Alexandria into a kind of high church Anglo-Catholic shrine, 6 candles, incense, the mysticism of that kind of Anglo-Catholicism. And it just touched something in me. I kind of fell in love with it. And after a couple of years, I went quietly to him and said, I think I'd like to be a priest. And he said, we'll send you to Kelham, which was this seminary in a monastic setting, which was founded to educate poor boys because the Anglican Church wasn't good at getting poor men into the ministry. It tended to go for the middle and upper classes and all of that. They're the ones that became the bishops. And Father Kelly had founded this order to train poor men for the Anglican ministry. And he said, we'll send you there. And off I went at 14, fell in love with it, and still ache for it. The building still stands, although the order is pretty much in its last legs, and they left Kelham in 1973. So, yeah, that's the beginning of the story.
You were clearly strongly drawn to the monastic life. So why didn't you go down that path in the end?
I was. The romance of monasticism, the mystery of Cistercian abbeys, monks getting up in the middle of the night. Again, I think it was all probably part of my romantic nature, this desire to give myself away to some big thing, give myself away to God. But I also discovered that there were inconsistencies in my own driven nature with the vows of poverty, celibacy and obedience, I guess. So again, it was a romantic urge for something I was incapable of achieving.
Did you love the kind of ritual, the kind of order it brings to life? And in particular, did you love the music and, for example, the plain chant?
All of that. The choirmaster at Kelham was a specialist in plain chant, Gregorian chant. He used to go and train other monks in the singing of it. And we sang the daily offices. Evensong was always sung, and then you'd have a high mass on Sunday, always to plain song settings. And I can still remember that evening in chapel, singing Evensong, singing the psalms to that tone, and just feeling my heart bursting with a kind of strange, sad pleasure. And plain song still does that to me.
Ian Barber, directing the choir of Belfast Cathedral in Psalm 114, when Israel went out of Egypt, sung using the tonus peregrinus, or wandering tone. The organist was David Drinkwell, and he brought a smile to my lips in that last line when he suddenly took the harmony into a new universe. Something else that's remained with you since your childhood is, I think, your passion for film.
Absolutely. Again, it was my mother that introduced me to that. I mean, during the war, there wasn't much to do. There wasn't much for us to do anyway. Pre-television, we had an old battery radio, but we had two picture houses in Alexandria, and my mother used to take me there regularly. And it's a habit that stuck. I watch most of my movies at home now on a big television screen, but I still love the movies. And my next choice actually is from a great complicated movie, Jane Campion's The Piano, with the pianist Ada McGrath, played by Holly Hunter. She's mute in the film, whether she refuses to speak. She speaks through the piano, and she moves from Scotland to New Zealand on a kind of husband contract thing that didn't work. And it's a piece of music that I revisited recently because I went to see the movie again. And it reminded me again of what Michael Nyman can do.
Michael Nyman, the pianist, in The Promise, from his score for Jane Campion's 1993 film, The Piano. Your very public campaigns, Richard, for women priests and gay rights brought you into conflict with the church early in your career. Indeed, you were offering gay couples marriage services as early as 1972. The Scottish Episcopal Church does now allow gay marriage, but the church in England does not. Why do you think gay relationships continue to be quite such a problem for the church?
I think that a lot of Christians just got stuck on a patriarchal ethic about sexuality as such. I mean, it wasn't great for women until fairly recently in religious institutions. We only started ordaining them in the Anglican Church 5 minutes ago, and that was a struggle that went on for a long time. The gay struggle is one in Scotland, one in the United States. It'll happen in England, I'm sure, but England always seems to take longer, partly because it's stuck in an establishment kind of straitjacket, I think, that makes it difficult to change things quickly.
You were deeply involved in caring for people with AIDS while you were a parish priest in Edinburgh in the 1980s, and you were with many AIDS patients as they died. How did that experience change you? Did it change the way you viewed your own death, perhaps?
I don't think it touched me in that way then. I'm much closer to the gate than I was then. The thing that most touched me in Edinburgh was the way that some churches saw it as the gay plague, God punishing gay people. But what happened was that other churches and the medical profession and social workers all got together and started working against that particular kind of rhetoric. There was a remarkable priest called Jane Milan, my diocese, who buried about 300 people who died of AIDS, and she showed me a kind of compassionate patience with suffering that touched me deeply. I wrote about her in my memoir, Leaving Alexandria, because in my experience, women often have this deeper pastoral patience than men. I've been a kind of an angry campaigner, but watching the women in my life that have touched me most deeply is they've simply gone under and been with those who suffered. And I think that on the whole was the picture that the Christian churches in Edinburgh presented at the end, that this was an evil that we had to struggle against, and we did and overcame it. There are now therapies, and out of it came good things, as very often is the case when human love withstands human hatred.
I wonder whether the next music, which is Jacqueline Dupré playing Elgar's cello concerto, in some way takes you to the tragedy and the glory of human life. I'm sure you know what I mean.
I do, absolutely, and you're absolutely right. I mean, I don't do jaunty music. I'm kind of deeply in touch with what I call the tears at the heart of things. There's a notion that there is something fundamentally sad and ultimately losing in the human condition, and yet out of it has come great art and great music. And Elgar's Cello Concerto, which of course was, he composed it during the summer of 1919, and the summer before in Sussex, he'd heard the guns in Europe across the Channel. I mean, it was his response to the astonishing madness of human nature. We go warring with each other. I mean, I'm 88 now, and I don't think I've lived at a time when there hasn't been a war. We haven't been fighting somewhere. And the Cello Concerto just captures the deep sadness at the heart of human history, that we can't somehow learn just to love one another. We're constantly fighting and challenging and strangling one another. And the Cello Concerto just captures that for me. It brings the sorrow of human history into this music, and I kind of cry just listening to it, yet somehow transmutes into a kind of strange, passionate, sad glory. I can't find any other words for it. Let's just listen.
Thank you.
there is just something about music that allows us to bleed all our sorrows into it and find a strange kind of temporary healing that lifts you above them.
Jacqueline Dupré was playing music from the first movement of the Elgar Cello Concerto, John Barbirolli conducting the London Symphony Orchestra in that famous 1965 recording. And by the way, you can find details of all the music chosen today by my guest, Richard Holloway, if you visit the Private Passions webpage. If you'd like to find hundreds of previous editions of the programme, they're there on BBC Sounds to download and enjoy at your leisure. Richard, when you were appointed Bishop of Edinburgh in 1986, you had already developed a strong dislike of what you describe as religious overconfidence. What did you mean by that?
I think the opposite of faith is not doubt, it's certainty. Faith and doubt are coactive. They're in harmony with each other. And the people that end up running religions hate that because it lacks the kind of dogmatic fixed certainty that gives them power to run the lives of people and its institutions. And what happens when a great religious idea, a theme like grace or forgiveness or ecstasy, is given an institutional form, the people who run it are usually the people least able to understand the mystery of the original gift, and they turn it into an institution. It seems to me that in my experience of a long, long time in the church, I began to see that if you hold religious dogmas too strongly, they make you cruel. They say that gay people cannot have sexual relationships. They say that women cannot be ordained. And a big turning point for me happened in 1998. I went to a bishop's conference in Canterbury, and I was hoping that we would start nudging ourselves towards a more open way of understanding gay sexuality. And it turned into a kind of Nuremberg rally of bishops. It became a hate fest. And it kind of, it killed something in me. I couldn't be bothered any longer wanting to be associated with an institution that put its own integrity before human good. And institutions do that. So if you're running one, be very careful because it might have killed your spirit.
Do you think that many clergy perhaps go through their lives afraid to voice their doubts about their faith?
Oh, I think that's undoubtedly true because they might get sacked by the management of local churches. I mean, we have a deep need for religion in the sense that we're puzzled by our own existence. Where did we come from? Where are we going? What does it all mean?
Yes, and you also love walking, poetry. You're uncomfortable, really, with the rules of institutions. So I can't help wondering, in a sense, if you're not a bit of a romantic rebel.
I think there's probably something in that, and it takes you a long time to get to know who you are. We're thrown into existence. We didn't choose our parents, our social background. And one of the things about a long life is you kind of get to know yourself over the years.
Well, if there is a romantic element to your rebelliousness, Richard, we can certainly find it in the work of our next composer, Rachmaninoff.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Yeah. This particular piece I've chosen, Rhapsody on a Theme by Paganini. By the way, Paganini means little pagan, but he was a kind of genius, and Rachmaninoff picked this up. This extraordinary theme, and I hope you're going to give us the achingness of it. And it's just, again, one of those things that lifts you out of words into a kind of an aching silence, because it too speaks of the longing for meaning and transcendence, but doesn't deliver it. So it's a kind of aching piece of music. Thank you.
Music from the Rhapsody on a Theme by Paganini, by Rachmaninoff. We heard the London Symphony Orchestra with the soloist Tamás Vášary and the conductor Yuri Aronovich. Richard Holloway, during the many years you served as a parish priest, how aware were you of the tension between being constantly available to your often very needy parishioners and being there for your family?
Yeah, I'm not sure I got that balance right. Although they tell me that it was fine. I mean, the rectory in Jeffrey Street, Lauderhouse for Old St Paul's, where we were for 12 years, was a big drafty house, and we filled it with waifs and strays. And how my wife Jeannie coped, well, she did, because she's an extraordinary calm person, and she presided over a lot of this chaos and confusion. But a wee bit of me, the regretful bit of me, wishes I'd been a wee bit more present in the active life of my children as children, rather than being this splendid vocational priest giving himself away to everyone else. That's a bit of regret there.
You mentioned that women often, you felt, bring a greater calmness to their pastoral care. And I imagine Jeannie, your American wife, must have needed that a bit and helped you by having it, because it's a vocation in itself, isn't it, being married to a priest?
A lot of spouses of clergy don't like that nowadays, because they were all, in one way, they were kind of seen as cheap help. Jeannie came from a lineage of clergy spouses. Her father was an American Presbyterian minister, her grandfather. So she brought with her a tradition of service. And she came from this middle-class Manhattan family into this kind of intense Scottish atmosphere, and just carried it off with an extraordinary organized calm. We were a very good balance, because I'm hasty, impulsive, she's calm and thoughtful. And I think we achieved a weird kind of symmetry. Looking back, I sometimes wonder how we did pull it off, but we did, and they were happy, happy years.
You've chosen now to hear part of a requiem, Brahms requiem. And I think this is something, actually, that Jeannie used to sing.
That's right. She sang in the Edmund Bach Choir for years, and she gave it up a couple of years ago. And when I asked her to provide a choice, she chose Ihr Habt nun Traurigkeit from the Brahms requiem. You know that I have sorrow, but I will see you again, and your heart will rejoice. So this is a bit of Brahms.
Margaret Price, the soloist, and music from A German Requiem by Brahms. Andre Previn conducting the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra and the Ambrosian Singers. Richard, in your most recent book, Stories We Tell Ourselves, you embrace the unknowable enormity of the universe and offer actually none of the traditional religious comforts of a divine creator of life after death. And yet it's uplifting, almost celebratory, about our fleeting existence on this planet. What do you think your teenage self in the seminary would have made of it and where you have now arrived at?
Oh, you would have hated it. I said when at my last sermon as bishop, I said I'd become in my 60s the kind of bishop I hated in my 30s. Those dogmatic certain years, you know, that Christianity was a package. But I've become more comfortable with uncertainty. I think it's truer to truth and human experience. But the thing that keeps me poised on the edge of the possibility of transcendence is that it's produced us. We are artists. In us, the universe is thinking about itself. And that's why I can't ever call myself an atheist, that the thing just popped into existence out of absolute meaninglessness and will pop back into meaninglessness. But nor am I confident about how to interpret it, which is why in that book, The Stories We Tell Ourselves, I explore all of this. I look at the arguments for non-meaning and the arguments for meaning. None of it seems permanently to explain itself in an absolutely convincing way, except to those who are already wanting to be persuaded that they've got it right. And as we've kept saying in this conversation, Michael, that can make you cruel, because if people don't like your political or religious ideas, it gives you an excuse to persecute them. And religion has been bad at that over the years, simply because it couldn't live with this kind of mystery, this notion that it's wrestling with the reality it can't quite grasp, and that it might not even be there. But I come back at the end of the book to Jesus, and the big teaching of Jesus is that we must learn to forgive one another and learn to forgive ourselves, which is probably the toughest thing to do. It's the essence of it. It's the thing that really matters. So I end up in my kind of religious struggles with a commitment to Jesus as the poet of forgiveness, calling us to forgive one another and, above all, to forgive ourselves, because we are kin to one another, and from our own weakness only will we learn that kind of supreme kindness. My God, wouldn't that be a thing to give your life to?
Well, we're going to end with a hymn you sang in the seminary at Kelham, O Blessed Creator of the Light. I wonder what effect it has on you when you sing it now.
I hear it at Evensong at Old St. Paul's. They sing it to the Plainsong melody, and it touches me. It brings tears to my eyes. There's a kind of longing in the music, a longing for there to be a blessed creator of the light, a blessed and happy and loving creator, because a lot of the creators we've invented have been vengeful and killing and horrible. And so it's, again, the music aches with a longing for something that may not be there, but the longing for it can make us better people.
Well, going back to Plainsong is a bit like going back to the beginnings of music. So, Richard Holloway, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Richard Morehouse, directing the choir of Llandaff Cathedral in the hymn O Blessed Creator of the Light, with the organist Michael Hoag. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, Richard Holloway. The episode was produced by Jane Greenwood, and it was a Loftus Media production for Radio 3. Next Sunday at midday, Michael's guest is the architect Francesco D'Amosto. On 90 to 93 FM, digital radio and BBC Sounds, this is BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Chris Sparrow. President Volodymyr Zelensky has renewed his call for the West to donate planes, tanks and missiles to Ukraine. NATO leaders have given Ukraine anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles, but have not yet offered any tanks or planes. President Zelensky asked whether the West was holding back supplies because it was intimidated by Russia. Ukraine's military intelligence chief has warned that Russia is trying to split the country in two with what he called the Korean scenario after failing to take the capital Kyiv. Kirilo Budanov said Vladimir Putin would try to foist a demarcation line between the eastern and southern regions and the rest of the country since he wasn't able to swallow the whole of it. The leader of a Russian-backed separatist region in eastern Ukraine has said that a referendum will be held soon about the area becoming part of Russia. Leonid Pasechnik told reporters he was certain that people in the self-proclaimed Luhansk People's Republic would overwhelmingly vote yes. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said his country is not trying to bring about regime change in Russia after President Joe Biden called Vladimir Putin a butcher who should not be allowed to remain in power. Mr. Blinken said the president was making the point that the Russian leader should not be allowed to wield power over Ukraine or its other neighbours. The British government has said Mr. Putin's future was a matter for the Russian people. The Education Secretary, Nadeem Zahawi, has said much tougher guidelines will be introduced in schools after what he called the hugely distressing strip search of a black schoolgirl in East London. The 15-year-old girl, known as Child Q, is suing the school in Hackney and the Metropolitan Police for allowing officers to search her in 2020 after she was wrongly accused of carrying cannabis. Her school has apologised, and the police officers involved, who are female, have been moved away from public-facing roles. Gatwick Airport has reopened its south terminal almost 2 years after closing it because of the pandemic. It means the number of flights that the airport can handle each day has almost doubled from 300 to 570. Now the weather, it's warm and sunny for many, but low cloud will linger in parts of England. There are highs of 16 in Edinburgh, 15 in Cardiff, 14 in Belfast and 13 in London. And that's the BBC News and Weather. It's 2 minutes past one.
Deep Night Tracks, an immersive overnight experience recorded at Radio 3's After Dark Festival. A night of live performance, innovative artists and exclusive collaborations to welcome in the clock change to British summertime. Take a journey through 900 years of music. A sound walk through moonlit forests and nocturnal landscapes.